to the dialogue series Dancing in the Liminal, a global border-crossing inquiry into art, activism, spirituality, and leadership. I'm your dialogue hostess, Vanessa Fisher, and I'm here with my guest, Dr. David E. Martin. David is the founder and chairman of MCAM Inc., the international leader in innovation finance, trade, and intangible asset finance. Actively engaged in global ethical economic development, David is the architect and founder of the Global Innovation Commons and the author of the International Legal Framework for the Heritable Knowledge Trust and Heritable Innovation Trust programs. David has pioneered global programs to bring corporate and stock market transparency to multinational extractive industries and has been instrumental in repatriating value to countries that have been subject to corporate and financial abuses. His work on ethical engagement and stewardship of community and commons-based value interests is at the forefront of global financial innovation. And I have personally been aware of and following David's work for about a year now, and I find what he's doing with MCAM truly fascinating, really unique, and engaged in the world in a way I find really impressive. So I'm really honored to have David here on my series. So thank you, David, for being here, and welcome.
Vanessa, thank you so much. It's wonderful to be on your show.
Great. So you're doing some really fascinating and important on-the-ground projects through your work with MCAM to really revolutionize the way we think about economics and innovation, currency, and value exchange. And I wanted to touch on a couple of the projects you're doing in this interview. And I also just wanted to say at the outset that some of the projects you're doing, some of the thinking that you're doing is really advanced and takes a certain amount of background knowledge in economics to really grasp. But what I want to do in the interview is really give the space to you for you to speak in depth about the work that's really meaningful for you, and also for me to help really make it accessible for a broad range of listeners. So my questions will sort of be geared in that vein.
That's great.
So the first project I'd like to talk about is the Global Innovation Commons, and which is really a revolutionary project that's transforming the way we understand the use of intellectual property in the form of patents. But before we get specifically into talking about the Global Innovation Commons and what you're doing with that particular project, I was hoping to have you give a bit of a brief definition of what a patent is. Some people just might not know. And also to speak a bit about the history of innovation itself and its connection to the historical evolution of intellectual property rights and patents. And I think this is quite a fascinating history that also gives a lot of larger context for the kind of edges you're pushing with your work with the Global Innovation Commons. So if you don't mind, just with a little bit of definition and history of that territory to start.
Sure. So let's go back to probably the first moment when the first human being struck the first two rocks together and created a spark, and then in that spark lit tinder, and with that tinder lit fire. The purpose of innovation at its core is to change the ecosystem in which you find yourself to be optimized or aligned to your interest. And if we think of innovation and creativity and realize that whether it's aesthetics, whether it's technology, whether it's any kind of adaptation, the innovative impulse or the creative impulse is that which comes when you decide that the conditions that you find yourself in would be improved if you did something, and the something is different than the natural order that you find. And so innovation at its heart is this real audacious human impulse to say, I've got this whole thing called the whole world, everything in this whole world, and I'd like to add my thing to it. And that's really that kind of core innovative creative impulse. Mm-hmm. Now, once you share that impulse, which is really where innovation really takes root, the sharing of the impulse, which is the ability to say, hey, guess what? I figured out how to hit these two rocks together and create fire. That's where you actually start creating the notion of community, introduction, and assimilation of innovation. And that's really the root of where the impulse to control innovation happened. Because also part and parcel of the human experience is this idea that there are people with whom I'd like to share my ecosystem, and there may be people with whom I wouldn't like to share my ecosystem. And so innovation becomes a utility, which is very tribal in its core nature, of saying that I'm creating this changed and transformed world, but there's a certain alliance that benefits from the creativity I have. And it may or may not be the same alliance, generally speaking, for all humanity. And so fast forward, 45,000 years, and find yourself in the 17th century in the UK. And what came about in the 17th century was the notion that as property and title were essentially the domain of sovereigns, they were able to grant property and title rights, the same implications were put on the idea of creativity. And the birth of the patent system was literally a land grant in the idea sphere. So by that I mean every idea, every creative impulse exists in really an abstract space. And what the 17th century British impulse was to actually imagine a world in which you could put stakes and claims. By the way, the reason why you hear about patent claims today is because titles and land grant patents, and that's what the common law and UK framework was at the time, is literally the staking of property rights in an idea space. And so patents have always been taking out of the public domain of possibility and putting into a property dimension space ideas that people have. And the social contract, and this is what was the improvement by Thomas Jefferson in the late 18th century in the United States, the improvement by Jefferson was to say that a patent, as we understand it today, needs to be a social contract in which someone teaches the world to do something meaningful and helpful. And that's why we have a patent that is a long written document that explains how you do something. But that long written document that explains how you do something, if in exchange for surfacing that for the benefit of all humanity, you do so in an adequate fashion, you are entitled to a limited period of time when you get to control the tribe that uses it. Okay? Mm-hmm. So we're taking that first impulse, that first tribal impulse, and we're actually codifying it. Right. And what a patent is supposed to be is a social contract that says that in exchange for explaining creativity in a way others can use it, you the author, you the inventor, you the creator, have the right to discern who gets to use it for essentially a 2-decade period of time. Right. Now, that's the principle, which is actually now the basis for the international patent regime. But that's the principle of it. Right. And to tie back into the opening of your question, the Global Innovation Commons is really creating the Library of Alexandria, if you will, where all of that teaching, the 86 million documents that have been surfaced by human impulses of creativity, can be made available so that the teaching side of the contract can actually have its intended use. Because in the last 30 years, what has happened is patents have become the domain of conflict and corporate litigation and things like that. And it really has robbed the public interest, the social contract, of its value.
Yeah, can you share a bit about that? Like, I think it was, you'd said sure. Something like 93% of patents are never used. Is that right?
Actually, slightly higher than that. It's approximately 95%. Okay. There was a study that was done several years ago by some researchers, Lemley and Shapiro. Phenomenal piece of work. And one of the things that they were looking at was the essential lottery odds of patent utility. Okay. And they concluded that when you actually go in and make a careful examination of how many patents a company or an individual might file, how many of them actually wind up being associated with goods or services that people ever use, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 5% that actually ever have utility in the form of being manifest in a product or service. Okay. Now, it's important just to point out that since 1981, which is a very important date that we're going to come back to, but since 1981, to suggest that the other 95% don't have any value would be in error, because what has happened is as the patent regimes around the world have become these contentious battlegrounds for litigation, having a giant portfolio of 10,000 patents or 80,000 patents, that portfolio number becomes a Cold War deterrent, where if you know somebody has 80,000 patents, you're less likely, the argument goes, to sue an 80,000 patent holder versus a 5 patent holder, because the 80,000 patent holder probably has more things to use against you.
Interesting.
So there is a deterrent value, which has totally and 100% hijacked the constitutional intent of the patent system as it was established.
Interesting. So what are these, if these patents aren't being used, I know you've talked about, so for example, certain patents are just bought so that they can prevent certain ideas from getting into the social community. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so very famously, you and the listeners will recall that we have been through a number of energy shocks in the last kind of 40 years. So if you go back to the 70s and think about the Carter administration and think forward from that, we've gone through many places where there have been questions about the spiking price of oil and our international dependence on oil and all of those kinds of very emotional types of market events. Mm-hmm. And during those periods of time, one of the very first impulses is for people to come up with alternative transportation technologies, hydrogen-powered cars, fuel cells, all sorts of these kind of very creative solutions. And when those solutions have arisen, many of which get patented, it is quite common for the incumbent industry leaders, whether those be chemical companies or energy companies or automotive companies, to buy the patents that show up on the scene and then shelve them so that no one gets to use them. And as a matter of fact, the vast majority of things like alternative energy, but surprisingly, things like nanotechnology, things like specialty materials and surface coatings, and a number of types of fabrics and other materials.
Do you think also cures for diseases?
Okay. Well, no question. As a matter of fact, one of the most egregious examples is one that we've written extensively about that comes out of the Pacific, where indigenous community leaders in the communities of persistence around the Samoa and Tonga and Fiji arenas were being canvassed by a series of Mormon missionaries. And as people were going through these villages, they were becoming aware of various healing technologies. Very famously in Falealupo, in the island in Savai'i in Samoa, there was a extract of the mamala tree that was being used to cure, not treat, but cure human antiretroviral problems, including the human immunodeficiency virus. And a researcher, Mormon missionary, took that technology, brought it to the National Institutes of Health and National Cancer Institutes, filed patents without ever mentioning the communities of persistence from whom the idea came, never identified them as the inventors, never identified them as the source of the innovation, filed patents on them, and then assigned them to a company that was a nonprofit AIDS treatment activist group that had no money to commercialize the research or to even conduct the FDA clinical trials, and essentially filed the patent and erased the ability to commercialize it from the face of the earth by virtue of assigning it to somebody who could never bring it forward. During the same period of time, AIDS treatments, which are tens of thousands of dollars a year, for the preservation of life with the disease rather than the treatment of the disease at a curative level were being expanded. Now, I will not make the statement that he was nefarious and working on behalf of the treatment organizations that benefited greatly by actually having AIDS persist and expand as a disease condition for the human condition, but I will say this without question. The fact that that patent was filed and buried served the financial interests of pharmaceutical companies and has led to the deaths of tens of thousands of people, if not many more. It could be hundreds of thousands or millions of people who had the ability to benefit from the communities of persistent knowledge in the Pacific Islands, who actually had means by which they could treat viral diseases. And that treatment, which is recognized to have had efficacy, including having had efficacy in trials done in the United States and by U.S. researchers, that technology to this day sits on the shelf and no one can use it because the patent is held and is not available for open and free use.
Well, let's dovetail a bit into speaking directly about the Global Innovation Commons. And I mean, I think it's a really fascinating project. And I had to read about it a few times before I really got it. And I mean, it's probably a bit over my head still. But you've talked about it as the composting site of the relics of the industrial economy, which I really liked. Yeah. I love that. And that you really aim with this project to emancipate innovation for future generations from this, what I imagine you say has become an increasingly enclosed system on innovation. Can you tell us a bit about what your intention is with the Global Innovation Commons, what it is, and so people can learn more?
Sure. So the idea of the patent, as I said, under the Jefferson-based 18th century legal regime, was a social contract that said in exchange for promoting the useful arts and sciences, if an inventor describes what he or she is seeking to protect with sufficient detail for somebody to use it, that they are then entitled to the patent right. So the social contract is you teach the world to do something, and then the world gives you the right for a period of time to benefit from that teaching. In 1981, in response to the growing concern that the Japanese had been out-inventing American industry, the Reagan administration promulgated a series of rules which actually led to the liberalization of how patents are granted. It used to be that you actually had to truly invent something, including showing that your idea could be put into practice. But because we were being out-invented by the Japanese, the U.S. changed the regime so that it was quite easy to get a patent on an idea, not necessarily on something you'd proven worked. What you see in 1981 is a proliferation of patents, and by proliferation I mean an order of magnitude increase in the number of patents being filed. And this is as a result of the liberalization of granting rules, and it's also as a result of an act that was done in the late 1970s called the Bayh-Dole Act. And the Bayh-Dole Act was when academic publications actually were transformed into an impulse to patent by virtue of the fact that it was legal for researchers at universities to file patents on their research and benefit from the economics. Mm-hmm. So that was the Bayh-Dole Act in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. And by 1981, you have academicians and you have industry just hemorrhaging with patent filings. Now, what happened as a result of that is that ideas, not products and services, but ideas started being annexed in this property space of the intellectual property universe that we talked about before. Mm-hmm. And these were ideas that may or may not have ever been reduced to practice. They may or may not have ever been taken as far as actually showing feasibility. But the idea itself was essentially taken out of circulation. And because the U.S. had the most aggressive granting regime, the world adapted its programs to actually prefer to file patent applications in the United States. So what happened was, you have this massive proliferation of U.S. patent filings, but in the context of that, your listeners need to know a tiny bit about patent law, mm-hmm. and that is that a patent is only enforceable in the market in which it's granted. So if I get a U.S. patent, that does not mean that that patent has any enforceability in, say, South Korea, or in Vietnam, or in China. And so what happened was, during the 1980s and 1990s, U.S. patent filings outstripped patent filings in the rest of the world by several times over. So it was exceptionally common, for example, if you were a researcher in South Africa, you wouldn't even file a patent in South Africa. You'd file a U.S. patent and mistakenly believe that by getting a U.S. patent, somehow that meant that the rest of the world was covered. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not the case. As a matter of fact, every place that you haven't filed that patent is open to use and practice your invention. And the problem is that people don't know this. So the impulse to create the Global Innovation Commons was twofold. One was to emancipate the innovation that has been filed and nobody knows about it. So there was a pure information disclosure idea that said that if patents had been granted, the social contract or the social benefit of the teaching should be available for anybody, which is part of what the impulse was. But the other part of the impulse was to say that if hydrogen vehicles, to use an example, or if fuel cells, or if AIDS treatments, or if the next way to weave seamless pantyhose was something that somebody wanted to develop outside of the protected market, that as a tool of economic distribution of wealth, it should be available such that there are ways that a practitioner in Tanzania, if they want to set up an industry that can export to the rest of Africa a good or service that is blocked from distribution in the U.S. by a patent, that person in Tanzania should be able to have all the information available to them to use the innovation, the social contract, and use it to create the basis of industry. And that's the real breakthrough, Vanessa, because we talk about all kinds of theoretical kind of millennium development goals about poverty eradication and social justice and balancing out the economic ecosystem. But as a practical matter, humanity has done a lot of talking about it, but hasn't done anything to actually really unleash it at a global scale. And what the Global Innovation Commons says is that the ideas that fueled the West's expansion of technology and of industry, if we're serious about creating a world in which there is some form of equivalency of access, not equality, but at least equivalency of access, mm-hmm. then we need to take the raw materials, the creative impulses of the places of asymmetric excess and make those tools available to everybody on Earth. And the Global Innovation Commons is the first place that there is an unrestricted access to human creativity biased towards what has surfaced in the industrial West over the last 30 years, made available to the world, unrestricted, and at the only cost, and this is an important cost, of the fact that anyone using information in the Global Innovation Commons is obliged to share their insights and their information back into the community, so that the idea of benefit is actually benefit that, if found in one market, can be also adapted and used in other markets. Right.
And what I love about this too, and I think you spoke about this, was how it kind of is like this ironic turn on the capitalistic system itself. So because all of the countries that were actually, you know, have been more in poverty are going to be the places where that are most rich for innovation and use of these patents. So that, I find that
no question,
which is really
no question.
Yeah.
It is as though for 30 years, the industrial West has deposited creativity in the Reserve Bank for what we have referred to disparagingly as the developing world. And oddly enough, now the developing world becomes the source of a emergent reduction to practice engine, where all of these ideas that were so unbelievably ahead of their time. So carbon alternative energy and cures rather than treatments for disease. The notion of new materials, the notion of real breakthrough technologies in communication and power transmission, all of these things are actually free and unrestricted for entrepreneurs in the world that was neglected and in the world which was thought not to be, quote, a relevant market. All of these ideas are now available as the seeds to catalyze the emergence of a brand new economic paradigm in which the value of a technology has less to do with your market restriction and it has more to do with the ability to introduce quality products into the market at such a level that consumers choose the mode of business rather than are forced into accepting the proprietary restrictions of business. Right. And that's an enormous, the statement I just made is an enormous breakthrough in the next evolution of markets. Because we have lived under the illusion since Adam Smith that the corporation dictates to the consumer what the consumer should want. And the emergent reality that comes out of the Global Innovation Commons is now you have to be in a position where the consumer chooses rather than being dictated to by the industrial impulse.
Awesome. Yeah, I think it's just awesome. And I was going to say, too, if you go to, if people want to go to your the Global Innovation Commons website, it's just amazing the amount that you've put together and categorized and just made really simply available for people. It's just a really amazing project. So,
well, it's fascinating, Vanessa. One of the backstories on the Global Innovation Commons is actually quite hilarious because shortly after it launched, I was at a meeting that involved folks from the United Nations and a bunch of NGOs, and they thought that this was such a radical and heretical idea, and they were most concerned. In fact, one of the senior executives from the United Nations looked at me after being introduced to the platform and said, "You should be fearing for your life because large industrial interests are going to be very upset with you." And I said, "That's fascinating. I don't." And the reason why I don't is once unleashed, you can never put this back.
Yeah.
So this is not something that I can control by virtue of will. But I said one of the fascinating things was within 36 hours of the platform being indexed and available online, we had users in every continent on Earth. And within 48 hours, we had all but two countries on Earth that had actually accessed the platform.
Wow.
And to put that in context, I made the announcement that it was going live in Florianopolis, Brazil, at an InfoDev conference, and 48 hours later, with no marketing and no promotion and no rollout campaign and no Twitter blast feeds and no Facebook promote and no nothing, by merely making this available, the world found it in 48 hours.
Wow.
And if you sit back and ask yourself, when was the last time an Adam Smith industrial behemoth, GE or Microsoft or Oracle, when was the last time they had a 48-hour global market penetration on any product? Mm-hmm. The answer is it's never happened. But when you emancipate the human creativity, yeah, it finds its way.
Yeah, definitely. I was interested in what you talked about in one of your interviews about a myth of American supremacy in innovation. And it's something I hear a lot, like, you know, we say that America is at the forefront of innovation, and sort of this false belief that innovation is ever really the domain of one country. I was curious if you just wanted to give a little bit of maybe a story or just some history about how, you know, basically how collaborative innovation really is between different countries, you know, how that's operated historically and today.
Sure. If you go back and look at the myth of the American inventor, we very famously have the agriculture inventing the cotton gin, Eli Whitney. We have the very famous American inventor inventing the steamboat, and we have the very famous inventor that invented the dual reciprocating camshaft, which was the thing that was the basis for the internal combustion engine. And what we fail to realize is that none of those actually started off as American impulses. Fast forward, my favorite example is that we think of Silicon Valley as this phenomenal miracle of a artifact of the American West and the American ingenuity and all of that good stuff. And if you go back and really look at what happened in Silicon Valley, what you'll realize is that during the Second World War, a very significant amount of effort was being done that was a collaboration between the UK Intelligence Office, the Australian Intelligence Office, and the United States Department of the Navy to try to figure out how to crack the JN-25B Imperial Code of Japan. What I love about that story is that our entire computer impulse was born of trying to crack the code of the very effective cryptologists in Japan. So far from being an invention, we were actually trying to reverse engineer an invention in Japan, which led to the computer industry. To suggest somehow that we just got lucky and stumbled into what became Silicon Valley is the biggest illusion of all. We actually got Silicon Valley because we couldn't figure out the intelligence and the sophistication of Japan's cryptologists. So to suggest that somehow or another we invented computers or we invented the ability to do digital data analysis is not only falsifiable by evidence, but it's also falsifiable in its impulse. That creativity came from a supra-creativity, a context that had been created by Japanese during the Second World War. And if you go back and say, well, yes, but didn't Silicon Valley become a hotbed of innovation and creativity, and isn't this a great American success story? The answer is, again, falsifiable by evidence. If you look at the fact that at the end of the Second World War, one of the very interesting pieces of history that gets ignored was that the German government was forced to turn over patents and patented technology to the United States as reparations for the end of the Second World War. Included in that was a very interesting technology that had been created by the Third Reich to make the illusion of Hitler being in multiple cities at the same time, the magnetic tape, which was a way to record audio files onto a magnetic tape so that they could actually play with body doubles on balconies so that it looked like Hitler was in Stuttgart and it looked like he was in Berlin and it looked like he was in Munich all at the same time. That technology, which was German technology, was expropriated by the Allies at the end of the Second World War and given to A.M. Pontioff, who was the founder of the Ampex Corporation. For anybody who wants to go back and verify this history, they can go and drive down 101 in San Francisco, south of San Francisco, going down towards San Jose. And that wonderful building on the right-hand side of the road, Ampex Corporation, which now is a health clinic for a university, used to be the core of not only what created Ampex, which was the company that figured out how to do digital magnetic tape storage, but from that company, another little company was spun out, funded by a project that was run by the CIA. That project was a classified project called Oracle. Some people listening to this show might be aware of a company called Oracle. You also might go to a theater and hear Dolby surround sound. That technology also came out of Ampex. What's the point of all this? The point is that what we create as the illusion that we're somehow inventive in the United States is actually an illusion that ignores the fact that the seeds of our innovation are very seldom uniquely our own. Yeah. And more importantly, what America has been very good at, and I want to make sure that I'm quite clear on this, what America has been phenomenally good at is actually reducing into industrial scale ideas that they get from other places. Mm-hmm. The United States is a remarkable industrial engine, without question, and we are remarkable at putting large amounts of public capital, and by that I mean that the United States government, largely in the interest of our defense impulses, is willing to pay for technologies at a price and in a stage far ahead of what another country would be willing to do. So you would never have had Oracle if you didn't have the CIA. You wouldn't have the CIA if you didn't have the Cold War. And if you didn't have that expenditure, Larry Ellison would not be racing in the America's Cup. The fact of the matter is that technology, that business, and that industry is a direct result of the patronage of the United States. Now, the fact is that Oracle and Larry Ellison himself has been a great industrialist. I'm going to take nothing from his success, but I'm going to take a lot from the myth of its creation, because the myth of its creation actually is a myth. The substance of its creation is there were a group of people who were commissioned to do a project for the U.S. government's interest. They did not come up with the idea out of the blue. They were given a mandate to go form a particular way to access data. And the birth of the Oracle data architecture did not come from an ambiguous, oh, somebody ought to go do something. The birth of that came from a demand that was created by an industrial complex that was running the Cold War. And that's where the idea came from. It did not come from somebody sitting in a garage and going, oh, isn't this fascinating? Every idea, it doesn't matter what it is, every idea is an impulse to strike that spark in the darkness. But the darkness provided the context, and the stones provided the context, and the tinder provided the context. And we do ourselves no service by reinforcing the illusion that somehow or another there's this stroke of genius that results in a patent, and nobody contributed to it, and there's one inventor, and that's how it came into being. That's just not true.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, the other one of your projects I'd like to talk about is your work with the Heritable Knowledge Trust and Heritable Trust Innovation Programs. And you say that the traditional intellectual property frameworks that have been used in the U.S. and Europe are obviously based on values that are not held in other cultures, which probably ties in with what we've been talking about. And so you've developed the Heritable Knowledge Trust and Innovation to kind of address this gap. So could you share a little bit about the principles of the Heritable Knowledge Trust and Innovation, and also how you define heritable knowledge and how this is different from traditional intellectual property frameworks?
So yes, let's unmask a couple things. First of all, the colonial impulse dating back at least to the 15th century has been for someone from an Occidental country, you know, Europe or the Americas later on, to show up in somebody else's neighborhood and see in their neighborhood what they lack. So I go to a place and I see that they don't have running water and they don't have latrines or toilets, and I say, oh, these poor backward people, they don't have any means of hygiene. And the reason why I assume that is because I don't see what I'm looking for as my conventional understanding. I see the world through what's missing from my context. And in the industrial era, what that meant was we got to a place and we stole the land because people, quote, did not have an organized form of government. Well, what we really meant was they didn't have our organized form of government. And then when it came to technology, well, none of these people have phones, so they clearly don't have a way to communicate. So obviously there's something wrong with these people, and they need to be acculturated so that they understand that phones are a means of progress. So we bring this colonial observation mode of lack and scarcity as the mandate for what we call development. And the World Trade Organization created a program several years ago where they were trying to capture what they referred to as indigenous knowledge. Now, that term, as I've written about, is an offensive and colonial term. what we like to refer to in our organization as communities of persistence, people who have figured out how to live in a place for potentially tens of thousands of years, which is in fact a much more appropriate way to communicate about people in lands that you might be exposed to for the first time. Those communities of persistence have obviously worked out a lot of things, and they have worked out how to live, how to survive, how to thrive in areas that maybe none of the rest of us could even make it a day or a week. And so what we suggested was, rather than following the industrial model of innovation and enclosure, it would be a great idea to use contract law. And by the way, contract law has been around for a very, very, very long time. It actually predates property laws. Contract law has the good attribute of being perpetual, if it's perpetually maintained. And what we decided to do was create a framework which would allow people in communities of persistence to take their information and their knowledge that they wish to share with the rest of the world, document it in the way that they would wish to document it, and make it available under a contract of community, which says that if you use the information that's shared, that information implicitly starts with the transfer of knowledge, which is reciprocal. Not only do you tell the world how you do the thing you do from a community of persistence, but the person who's using it explains how they were inspired by what you had to offer, and the user of the knowledge actually takes information back into the community to set a context of collaboration as the first order engagement between the parties. And by establishing this notion of reciprocal knowledge exchange as the first thing that you do, you actually get away from the colonial abuses of taking advantage of communities by taking their information, never telling them the consequence of the utility of their information, and ultimately preserving the impoverishment of that community. So let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. If I know that essential oils used in fragrances in Asia are extremely valuable, and I go to Papua New Guinea, and I go to East New Britain, Papua New Guinea, and I say, wow, there's a lot of lemongrass and patchouli and cardamom and all kinds of wonderful organic spices that are being grown across East New Britain. And I take a colonial impulse to that question. What I'll do is I'll meet with all of the growers, I will give them a commodity price, and I'll never tell them how much that fragrance is worth in a bottle of Shiseido cologne or perfume. If, however, I take a different view, which is to say, teach me how you've used this particular spice or fragrance, and they show me how they cook it, and they show me what temperatures that they've used to manifest the best fragrance or the best flavor or whatever it happens to be. And they teach me first. And then I come back and I say, you know what? In Japan, this particular fragrance has extremely high value inside of a little glass bottle called fragrance. And that little glass bottle called fragrance gets sold for 80 euros or 90 euros a bottle. By exchanging that information, the community can say, well, we would love to participate in that. At which point in time, we would then engage in teaching the community how to prepare the product in a way that can be best implemented for that cosmetics or fragrance company in Japan. Now, I'm giving you a hypothetical that's not a hypothetical. This actually happened. What we then engage is we look at the community, the local community, and do an assessment that we use a process called integral accounting, where we actually assess what the community has in abundance. It turns out that East New Britain, Papua New Guinea, was the conflict-filled region during the Second World War, where the Japanese actually had a military outpost, and unfortunately was also the place of a forgotten but quite genocidal impulse at the closure of the Japanese occupation, the very famous Rape of Rabaul, in which numerous people were violated and killed as part of the end of conflict in Rabaul. But it turns out that the Japanese left Rabaul, Papua New Guinea, in haste and left behind things like torpedo tubes and munitions and all sorts of other military technologies. Well, Vanessa, it turns out that if you want to make essential oils, you need steel compression chambers. Wouldn't it be funny if Japanese fragrance buyers today were getting essential oils made from Japanese torpedo tubes that were left behind after the rape of Rabaul, where women in Japan today are now wearing the fragrances that are extracted for beauty out of the carnage that had happened in Rabaul? Wouldn't that be a fascinating hypothetical that's actually happening today? So what is the Heritable Innovation Trust? What it is this reciprocal exchange of information where you start by honoring the is state of the knowledge and the practices in communities of persistence around the world. And by acknowledging that, you learn from them how they've done and used and practiced certain things. And rather than taking the medicine man approach of saying, I'm going to find the medicine man, I'm going to steal his ideas and go make a pharmaceutical, you actually say, no, I'm going to engage with that community. And if it turns out that pharmaceuticals are an output, I'm going to work locally with communities to engage in that process. I will tell you that the karma of the story I've told you about the fragrances in Japan, mm-hmm. that karma is changing the world. The idea that you can take a war-torn, conflict-filled story, which is just horrifically ignored by the majority of the world, and turn it into the basis for an industrial collaboration where this day in Papua New Guinea, there is essential oil being extracted using Japanese torpedo tubes, and those essential oils are gracing the bodies of Japanese women today. And rather than having violence beget violence, we are totally inverting that process. And we are allowing the instruments of war and the instruments of conflict and the stories and legacies of abuse to turn into the basis of remarkable economic engagement, which is the envy of the world, given the fact that the essential oils we're now producing in East New Britain are actually the highest grade and highest quality that exist on the planet. And Amruka, which is the partner that we work with in Papua New Guinea, is actually known for producing too high quality oil that actually has to be slightly contaminated to meet industrial standards because it's that good.
Fascinating. Well, just to bring everything to a close, if people want to learn more about MCAM or what you're doing, and or even just want to get involved in some way, is there any resources you would recommend for people? I know you do internships. I know there's a few different things you're doing. If you want to share any of that before we close.
Certainly. We have a engagement love affair with the world. So fact of the matter is we have in-country and local internships in a lot of places around the world. We have affiliates in countries as diverse as you can imagine, where we do a lot of things like on-the-ground internships and projects. So we have the ability to place people into communities of consequence in various parts of the world. There's kind of no place that you can go anywhere on this planet where you're not 8 hours away from something we're doing. So that's kind of an exciting thing. We also have local internships where we bring people into the headquarters in Charlottesville, Virginia at MCAM and engage people in internships there. We also have large numbers of academic collaborations and cooperative partnerships that we have in various institutions around the world. MCAM is the core commercial operation that we run, and that headquarters is in Charlottesville, Virginia, in the shadow of Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, in the neighborhood of the University of Virginia. So it's a great place for people who are in the academic stages of their life to be connected. We also have a number of virtual presence out in the internet world. We have the Global Innovation Commons that we've mentioned. We have the Heritable Innovation Trust, which is another very dynamic platform that we operate. And then I keep a weekly commitment to all of my friends around the world by writing and try to keep a dialogue going with now readers from pretty much every country on earth. And that's another way to stay in touch.
It's a great blog.
We are delighted to have collaborators and cooperators and individuals who know that there's a better way. Be involved and be part of the active use of a new economy rather than the theoretical conversations about wouldn't it be nice if somebody someday would do something different.
Great. Well, I'm really excited about what you're doing, and I hope we can stay in contact, and who knows, maybe I'll like to do an internship one day. I'm global nomading, so it sounds like a perfect opportunity.
It does indeed. I look forward to that, yeah. Vanessa, and thank you so much for taking the time.
Absolutely, yeah. It was a lot of fun and informative for me, too. So thank you.